So like next, like Friday, Thursday.
Great. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. I realize that there is still homework I have to grade, but that still makes the homework due today. And I was basically hoping that I grade once more and then I'm done with homework grading. Are there questions?
Yeah, on the homework.
65?
Yeah. 65. Was that... I was having difficulty making sense of it being matrices of size P by P, where P is the number of partitions.
So, the idea there is... there was a theorem in class for expressing the elementary symmetric functions in terms of the monomial symmetric functions. That was lemma 524. And just giving a description of these coefficients. And now we don't have the elementary symmetric functions, but we have the homogeneous symmetric functions. And they have the same... I mean, the P is just there as some parameter. How big are the matrices? What's the dimension of the space?
Okay.
That's what I call P, and I thought... And the only reason for writing this sentence there is to make clear what kinds, because I'm also talking about matrices... this is the types of media. So the P is what kind of matrices am I looking at? I'm looking at matrices which would be in the dimension number of partitions of lambda, but they are not the base change matrix in itself. I'm counting the number of matrices. And essentially the idea was to duplicate what 524 does, just there we have not different necessarily in the elementary symmetric functions, we have terms of with different variables for the homogeneous, right? We have E1, E2, so E1 was x1 plus x2. Well, that is the same. E2 was x1, x2 plus x2, x3 plus x1, x3, and so forth. And if we are doing the homogeneous symmetric functions, we are also allowing duplicate variables. So what we have there is, if we have H2, that would be E2 plus x1 square plus x2 square plus x3 square. So the argument, which in the proof of 524 is about, where it is saying, well, it's a product, we have the EIs are products of different variables. Here we don't have different variables anymore. And if you essentially do the same kind of argument, so the matrices will not be 0-1 matrices as before, where the 1 indicates the variable is there, but the entries in the matrices can be bigger because they will give with which exponent is the variable there. And then the 524 proof, if I remember correctly, basically the kind of argument goes through exactly in the same way and gives you the argument for that homework problem.
Okay.
Did anyone do it and notice that worked, or no? So if you want, we can, I mean, this is your choice. If you want, we can go together through it.
Can I turn homework into you at the Combinatorics seminar?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I can take a look at it.
Okay. So if you're still, or look at it, and if you're still stuck with it on Monday, let me know, and then I can go over it. But really, what I remember is it is very similar to 524, and I think it actually in Stanley's book, he doesn't even give this separate as a proof, but he just says this goes exactly the same way.
By the obvious thing. I have a question.
Yeah.
On the exam, I don't know which number it is, but the one where you have the library books.
So yeah.
When you're not swapping library books, right? You're
no,
putting one where
no.
the other is and taking it out.
I'm taking one out, and I assume the whole library is one long shelf, and I think at least at some point the problem said this even, that it is assumed to be one long shelf. So you're taking the book out, you're pushing books aside to make space for it, and put it in again.
Okay.
So you're
potentially removing and inserting it?
Yeah, but let me look at that.
And your question was that you're not swapping it out for something else?
Yeah, I'm not doing transpositions.
Okay.
No. You're taking it out. You're not swapping it with another book.
Okay.
So what you're doing is basically, effectively you're doing a cycle permutation. So if you have, let's assume you have books A, B, C, D, E, F. Okay. And now you're taking some book out, let's say E. You're taking E out, and you're putting E in here by pushing C and D to the side. So what you're doing is not a transposition of two books, but you're actually doing a three cycle. And you could have a cycle of arbitrary length by just going far enough away and putting it in there. So that is the process clear what
yes,
happened. You might want to look at this in some examples to see what is happening. And if you don't have an idea, you might want to look. I think that problem is out of Knuth's book, and Knuth has at least solution hints in the back.
That's too far. I can't do that.
That one, it doesn't say it explicitly. I'm assuming N is the number of books, right?
If that is, I mean, it would be plausible to have some variable for the number of books. And if there is an N which otherwise isn't specified, that would be probably the number of books. Yes. sorry, I don't have the text here, and it could be, and I don't remember, this is some weeks ago when I wrote it.
If there's no other mention of N, so
yeah.
It's just at the end.
Yes, by if and only have of length N minus K. Yes, N would be the number of books. Yes. Other questions?
For the paper one, I just, it's hard for the guidance because I know that you grade so easily on the homeworks. I mean, I don't know, because you just like put a check next to stuff, even though
yeah.
I know that it was
yeah.
not like the best proof. But like, I guess I don't want to like give too much of
So what I want to see with the final and with the qualifier, that you can use the tools from the class to solve problems from combinatorics. So this is something, well, it's counting some things. And again, I don't remember, what am I asking? Well,
super simple,
give a formula. So give a, how many are there? Right? Give a formula for it. So
like a bijection is sufficient.
Could, if you have a bijection to some other set, that is sufficient.
Okay.
Or how have we done such bijection? We have done it sometimes explicitly by giving a bijection from object to object, or we have done it that we found a recursion which is satisfied by these objects, and we just said this recursion is satisfied by these objects. We know already this recursion satisfies these other objects, and the recursion completely defines the object, and for the other objects we have a count, and then we can just borrow the result there.
Okay.
So in this problem, I think the idea was something to probably show that some kind of recursion is satisfied.
Okay.
And if you look at the first, try it for a few small numbers, and you probably have an idea what recursion is. Other questions? No? Okay, so what we did last time is we looked at the Robinson-Schenstedt-Knuth algorithm, well, it's, which is, isn't really built as a formal algorithm, in the, that they said, oh, here we have a very specified problem we want to solve, but it's a process which is described in algorithmic form, which takes a permutation and does certain things with it. And the reason how it was developed was basically to find a way to get certain properties about this permutation considered as a sequence of numbers. So, for example, it turns out that with these tableaus, the number of rows, and initially there was just a process which built one tableau, and then the next step was to realize, oh, we can build a second tableau, and then it has a bijection. But building the first tableau, it turns out that the length of the first row is the length of the longest increasing subsequence. The number of rows is the length of the longest decreasing subsequence. And one can interpret, and then the length of the second row actually would be the length of the second largest disjoint increasing subsequence. So you take the longest increasing subsequence, if you would delete these entries, and you now look in the remaining ones, what is the longest increasing subsequence you have there? Well, that's the length of the second row of the tableau, and so on. So that's what this process, that's in some way where the process comes from. But it turns out that it builds a bijection, and basically we were at the place of justifying that it is a bijection. And well, let me maybe start to actually justify what is happening, why it is a bijection. Let's start doing it in one more example. I also, since some of you asked me about the, and apparently this app doesn't exist for downloading anymore, but the author has made JavaScript applets. So I sent you an email with a link to a web page which has JavaScript applets which should work on most web browsers for enumerating, for doing this process. Yeah?
So I understand that we have an injective like correspondence here, even though we have a map and it's inverse, but what are we bijecting onto? Like
onto the pairs of tableaus of the same shape.
Okay.
So what we need to do is basically to justify that it is a bijection. We will show there is a reverse map which takes a pair of tableaus and produces a permutation, or produces a two-row array which is a permutation, which represents a permutation. And then we show that these are mutually inverse. Right?
Right. Okay.
And that shows that there is a bijection.
All right,
that shows the onto, because now if they're mutually inverse, and you need to see they are mutually inverse in both ways, then you know that you get onto, because you do the inverse operation to get the permutation which would map onto a particular pair of tableaus. But let's probably start with some example. So let's say, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six just happens to be a number where it's small enough to do and large enough that you don't just get some pathetic cases. Okay, and this is really just randomly chosen. So, what do we do? We start, we go through the bottom row, which would be the permutation as a sequence. So, we have 5, and there is so far nothing. We place the 5, and in the Q tableau, we take the corresponding number here and we write it down. Next, we take, and probably let me, what I will now do is actually draw the separate steps one by one. So next we get a 1. The 1 goes in, we take the smallest number larger than 1, which is the 5. So the 1 bumps the 5 out. So the 5 goes in the next row, and I have 1, 2. Next I put the 3 in. The 3 is larger than 1. So I just put the 3 there, and I get in the Q tableau, I get 1, 2, 3. Next comes a 2. The smallest number larger than 2 is 3, so that bumps the 3 out. So I get a 2 here. The 3 goes in the second row. In the second row, the smallest number larger than 3 is 5, so the 3 bumps the 5 out. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4. Next comes 6. 6 is larger than 2, so I 1, 2, 6, 3, 5, and here I have 1, 3, 5, 2, 4, and finally I get a 4. The 4 bumps the 6 out, so I have 1, 2, 4, the 6 gets bumped out, 6 is larger than 3, so the 6 goes here, the 5 stays here, and I have 1, 2, 4, 3, 5, 6. Right? That's the process. What I now claim is, in the same way as we have done an insert, we can do an uninsert, right? Every step is an insert operation. So we can uninsert objects. And we can uninsert numbers which are on the edge. By on the edge, I mean they are at the end of their row and at the end of their column, right? Because every time the insertion process puts a number at the end of its row and at the end of its column. So, I can pick an arbitrary element at the end of its row and at the end of its column and uninsert it. So, the uninsertion would say, what happens, how did the number, if this tableau was produced just by an insertion process and it placed that number here, what would the insertion process have done? Well, here I inserted, so let's say it was the 6 which I want to uninsert. Well, 6 is in the at the end of the second row. So, well, actually if a number is placed, if the process ends, the number is always placed at the end of some row, right? Because otherwise something is bumped out and goes further. So, what will have happened is the 6 was placed here, and before the row was a 3. So, and below nothing happens, so in the, so I can take the 6 off, and anything here was before this. I have already what how it was before, indeed. It was 3, 5. So, by this being not the first row, the 6 must have been bumped out of the previous row. How would it have been bumped out? Well, by being the smallest number larger than something which I placed. So I take the largest number smaller than 6 in this row. This is the 4. And I know the 6 must have come from this place, and the 4 is what was put in. Right? And that's how I can uninsert the 6, and I would get that tableau back. I could uninsert other numbers at the edge. I could uninsert the 4. Right? If I uninsert, if it was the 4, then the tableau before must have been like this, and the 4 was just came in and said there is nothing larger in the first row, I just added at the end of the first row. So then the uninsertion ends with a different, actually a differently shaped tableau. Or I could uninsert the 5. If it was the 5 I uninsert, I would say, okay, the 5 goes away here. So that must have been the previous shape. The 5 would have been bumped out by the 3. So then the 5 would go here, and the 3 would have been bumped out by the 2. So I would have 1, 3, 4, 5, 6 before, and the 2 is what came in. And what I was planning was not to write down this uninsert process also in a fully algorithmic form. Why does the uninsert process, if I do this with, so I can do it with an entry on the edge, why does this get in a tableau if I uninsert an entry? Well, in the rows, I will place numbers, I will change numbers only by replacing a number by something slightly larger, but not larger than the next one. Right? Because that's how I found out how they were bumped out. So that's why in the rows after uninsertion, the rows are strictly increasing. Why are the columns strictly increasing? Because, say, if I take this 6 and I go back here, because I have a tableau, the 6 must be larger than this. So, if I uninsert, the largest number in this row, smaller than 6, can only be above or to the right. It cannot be left to it. And because 6 is larger, okay, so if it is directly above, this is larger than this number, then it's also larger than this number before, by transitivity. If I'm going to the right, well, if I insert it back, I replace a number which is smaller, right? I replace the largest number smaller than 6. This number, however, by this being tableau before, was larger than the number above. So if I replace it with a larger number, clearly the column criterion is satisfied. So what I can do is I can take a tableau, I can take an entry on the edge, and I can uninsert that entry and get a tableau back which has one cell left, namely the cell where I started with, one cell on the edge less, and it has, well, then one number was taken out. That's, and it is pretty obvious that the insert and uninsert process are mutually reverse. I mean, that's how the uninsert was produced. So, now what is the reverse of the RSK process? I take the second tableau and look at the large... I start with two tableaus, and I take an empty two-line array. Okay. So I look at the largest entry in the Q tableau. That must be on the edge, right? It must be at the end of its row and at the end of its column, because otherwise this would not be a tableau. That gives me a position. I take that number, I write it in the first row, and I look at the position. That position tells me the position in the first tableau where I want to uninsert. So I want to uninsert the 6 here. We just did this before. If I uninsert the 6 here, I end up with this tableau, and the 4 went out. So I take the 4 and write it down here. Now I take the next largest here, the largest number. That is the 5. So the 5 tells me, I write the 5 down, and I need to uninsert this 6. It's at the end of the first row, so it was just the 6 which was inserted. So I put the 6 here. Largest number is a 4. That gives me this position, the position of the 5. I need to uninsert the 5 here. Well, 5 can only have come here by being bumped out by the 3. So I must have a 5 here, and the 3 only can have come here by being bumped out by the 2, so I must have 1, 3, 5. And the number which bumped it out, which started the bumping out, or the uninsert process at the end, has the 2 left, so I have a 2 here. Largest number is 3. That gives me also a 3 here at the end of the first row, so the 3 must have been what was inserted, so I take the 3 here. Remove that, so I have this tableau left. Largest number is the 2, so I uninsert the 5. 5 in the second row can only be there by having been bumped out from the first row. In the first row there is just the 1, so the 1 must have bumped out the 5. So there must have been the number, was it 2? And the number which comes out at the end of the uninsert is a 1. And then finally I have 1 and 5 here, and I have reconstructed this two-row array, which this permutation. So, and I will use this in two ways. On the one hand, I use it to say, this process is really the reverse of the RSK process. So, when I apply RSK to a two-row array, I get the tableaus, and I then apply this other process, I get back the two-row array. So, it's a right inverse. Furthermore, I can apply this process to an arbitrary pair of tableaus. Why can I do this? Because for the Q tableau, I'm removing the cell with the largest number, right? I'm removing a cell on the edge, and that will always a valid process which leaves me with a tableau. So for Q, this is a valid process. For P, I have argued that the uninsert process takes a tableau and leaves a tableau. So that is also a valid process. So I can iterate this uninsertion and removing the entries. So I can apply this reverse process to an arbitrary pair of tableaus, and I will get a two-row array. And if I take that two-row array and now apply RSK to it, well, I will, again, the way the processes are designed, I will get the original pair of tableaus back. And because insert and uninsert are mutually reverse. Well, if I take a pair of tableaus, what kind of two-row array do I get? If these are two proper tableaus, both involving the numbers 1 to n, well, then the first row then both rows of this two-row array will involve each of the numbers 1 to n exactly once. And the first row, because I'm always removing the largest number, the first row will be 1, 2, 3, 4, up to n. So I have a permutation. So that tells me that I get from permutations, I get every pair of tableaus. And vice versa, since I can apply it to every permutation, if I apply it to tableaus, I will get every permutation. So that gives me that I have a bijection. Okay. So, this was basically just a spoken argument there. This is one of the cases where the argument is text. And there isn't much, at least I don't see much value in trying to write that text on the board. And that's one of the reasons why there are tech notes, so that the text is actually in there in written form. But is this insertion and uninsertion process and the way how we get this bijection, is this clear how we get the bijection? Yep.
What about skipping? So, what if I want to take a permutation on 7? What if I have a tableau that skips some numbers in one dimension?
Okay.
Or a pair of tableaus.
Yeah, so if you have a pair of tableaus where numbers, they need to have the same shape, right? If you skip numbers, then you get a two-row array back.
Okay, yeah.
And in that two-row array, you will have the numbers of the Q tableau in order, with some skips, and you get then corresponding the numbers from the other tableau.
So how do you make a permutation off of that? I guess I'm confused because I haven't been doing arrays from permutations.
Okay, so, no, then you don't make a permutation from it.
Oh, you don't. Okay.
So, and that's, okay, so that's where I might have been slightly sloppy. So, RSK is a bijection between permutations and pairs of proper tableaus. Proper tableaus meaning they involve the numbers 1 to n without skipping.
Okay.
But the way we describe that process, in particular, you can start saying, oh, there is standard tableau and semi-standard tableau and so on. There are tons of terms and I didn't want to introduce them all. In between, that process has things which are not proper tableaus, which skip numbers.
Okay.
But at the end, what comes out are all the numbers from this two-line array. And if this is a permutation, that means both of these tableaus involve all numbers exactly once and therefore are proper tableaus.
Okay. Thank you. That was my bijection.
Yeah, no. So what you can do is, and that's basically what we are going to do next, to some extent. You can say, actually, the way we defined it with a two-row array, actually, these numbers could have skips. So we can say, if I take an arbitrary two-line array, where I just make the assumption which we have made, that the numbers in the first row are ordered to be increasing, and I have some numbers in the bottom row, I can again apply that process and I will get a pair of, not perfect tableaus. I will get a pair of tableaus which have numbers skipped. And so in some way, then I have actually I get a bijection on a bigger set. Namely, I have the set of all two-line arrays involving numbers in a certain range, and I have the pair of tableaus with possible skips of numbers which involve numbers in that range which I'm allowed to use. And exactly the same proof goes through. It's just permutations are nice sets of objects, And tableaus which don't skip are nice sets of objects, and that's why we are giving the bijection on there. But you can give the bijection actually on a larger set. And the reason why we want to allow skips is to justify the second process, the second part of the theorem, the fact that if we swap the tableaus, we get the inverse permutation. Well, this is not completely weird, because how would you invert the permutation? You would switch these two rows and you would sort the columns. Okay, so that's why switching, yes, in some way that should give us the inverse. But the weird thing is the switching doesn't work for the algorithm, because the algorithm does two very different things with the tableaus. But the two tableaus are not built by the same process, and so I can't say, oh, I switch here and the algorithm switches all, and therefore the rows switch. I'm really doing different things, and that's why I need to formally prove something. Okay. Have some minutes. Okay. I just saw my colleague who's teaching at the same she's teaching afterwards. Mumbling. Okay. So, what I want to do next is to look at the process with a goal towards showing that switching the tableaus corresponds to inverting the permutation. Oh, and what I should say is, I think now with this description, you will be able to do that problem on the take-home final, right? Mm-hmm. I give you a permutation. You can write down the corresponding two-row array. You can apply RSK to it. You will get two tableaus. Transpose the tableaus both and apply the inverse, and you will get a two-row array. So that's just what this problem is about. It's doing the process both ways, and I was too lazy to write down a pair of tableaus. That's why I was saying for the inverse, just transpose them. So it's a different task. So, to show what is happening, I need to analyze a bit more what this insertion process does. And in the way of doing this, we will as a corollary also get the result that the length of the first row is the length of the longest increasing sequence. And that, by the way, is the reason for, though you don't need that for the proof, but that's a bit the motivation behind this problem with a bookshelf. That not just we can count that in some way, but a longest increasing subsequence of a permutation in some way you can interpret in a at least semi-plausible way. It's not just some random object, but you can give it practical relevance. Well, it will turn out to be convenient to look at the construction process for the tableau line by line. Why then? Well, how do we construct this P tableau? We are taking a number and trying and are putting it in the first row. And at some point, numbers get bumped out of the first row. If a number is bumped out of the first row, it will never, ever, during that process, encounter the first row any longer, because I'm always bumping down. So, the second row, I can interpret as saying, well, let's initially just look at the P tableau, not at the Q tableau. I could split this insertion process into two parts. I could say, first, I'm doing the insertion process only for the first row, and I will build the first row of the tableau. What this will do as a side effect is that some numbers get bumped out one after the other. So I have a sequence of different numbers which come by and by as they were bumped out. And that's the numbers which will build the second row, third row, and so forth of the tableau. So, once I have, which I don't yet have, but once I would have a description of what, how I build the first row of the tableau, I know the second row, and or the rest of the tableau with the first row deleted, simply is the tableau I'm getting from the numbers which have been bumped out of the first row. Right? That's how this construction process works. And if I want to see now what is happening for the Q tableau, well, for the Q tableau, I'm not bumping numbers out. I just write the numbers one by one in an order which tells me, yeah, in the order as they come in this first row here, which if I have a permutation is just the order 1, 2, 3, and so forth up to n. But let's now look at the... So, I have these numbers, and if I look at the first row, that are the indices at which the first row is growing. Right? So, the indices, the numbers in the... Oh, sorry, that's P tuple. This is the Q tuple. These are the steps in the process as at which the first row of the tableau is growing, is adding cells. And then if I look at the other numbers, that's the positions at which something got bumped. So if I separate this process, let's go through again and let's write something else down. Let's write down separately what happens for the second row. So, in step one, I'm putting the 5 here. Nothing bump, just the first row. Now I have that 5 got bumped, and that happened in step two. So in step two, the 5 got bumped out of the first row. Next, I'm only doing things in the first row. Here, a 3 got bumped out of the first row, and that happened in step 4. So in step 4, a 3 got bumped out. Next, something only happens in the first row. I don't care about it. Now, here, a 6 got bumped out of the first row, and that was in step 6. So I can write that down. And what I produce is a 2-line array, right? Well, I wrote the numbers in 2 lines, and because the numbers I'm writing in the first row are a subsequence of the first row here, they will be in increasing order. And I have numbers here. So this is a 2-row array satisfying all the conditions which we wanted to have. And I will call this the bumped 2-line array. And what does this tell give me? If I take this bumped array and I apply RSK to this bumped array, I construct the tableaus from the second row on down, right? Because what would happen there if I start with this? Well, I take a 2, I have the 5, I place the 5, and I write in the other tableau the 2, that number here. And that's the reason why I wanted to define that process on a larger set. Next comes a 3. The 3 will bump out the 5. So the 5 goes here, and the number I have is a 4. Next comes a 6. The 6 is larger than 3, so I place it here, and I place that 6 here. So that 6 is this, that 6 is this. And that is exactly the parts from the tableaus, but the first row. So what I want to do is I want to look at the process as, on the one hand, constructing the first row and constructing this bumped tableau, because the bumped tableau gives me the second row and so on. Is that argument clear, what is happening there? Right? It's because anything which I'm constructing here comes, the numbers come bumped one after the other, and only then something in the second row and so on gets built with these numbers. So I can describe that process instead as a process of building the first row and constructing a bumped tableau. So now I want to see how do I construct the first row. Well, how do numbers get in the first row? They get into it by being larger than the number. Well, at some point they either bump something out or they get added at the end. But whenever they are put in, they are larger than the numbers before and smaller than the numbers after. And if they bump something out, the length of the first row does not change. So when does the length of the first row grow? It grows if and only if I get a number which is larger than the ones before, and then the numbers in the first row will give me an increasing subsequence. And whenever I have an increasing subsequence of a certain length, I will know that the first row of the tableau will grow to that length. Right? Because these numbers, at some point they come in, yes, they might get bumped out later, but that doesn't matter. That gives me the length of that row. So that is basically the reason why the length of the first row of the tableau is the length of the longest increasing subsequence. And what we will do next time is to look more carefully in which columns are the numbers put in, and knowing that will help us then for describing that we get the inverse. Right. Thank you very much. Have a nice weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.